Hi, everyone. It's Raghu, and I'm back with Mind Rolling and a new friend who I just said, you're brand new, but I already know you. Kelly Carlin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be here.
So Kelly has a great book. It's called A Carlin Home Companion, Growing Up with George. I don't think there's anybody out there who doesn't know who George Carlin is, but after reading the book and you meeting people, like trying to get a ticket out of Hawaii, right, when your father was passing, so you never know. But George is an icon, and the way in which he told the truth and made us laugh, that combo was unique in our annals of entertainment, for sure.
Yeah. His particular brand of truth-telling, you know, I think of, there were others out there, certainly Pryor being another one, could make you laugh and speak truth. But Richard's truth was from a slightly different angle, of course. But my dad had a way of always saying things that after you heard it, you would go, oh my God, I've been thinking that forever, but I've never actually even articulated it to myself before. Yeah. I always had a joy when I go and see his taping of his specials, because he would always blow my mind. Like one thing would completely blow my mind, and I'd walk out of the concert in some sort of like heightened state of awareness, because he had just opened another door of perception through his insight. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. Oh boy. I mean, now we all have difficulties in our lives, and we all have a whole pile of dukkha, suffering that is inimical to our existence as humans. But I thought I had a big pile. Yours was bigger than my pile, I think.
You know, I think each of our piles are our piles, and it's ours to sort through, you know, and ours to use for fertilizer, some of it, and some of it's to, you know, you just throw it out and go, I don't need that anymore. And then some of it you hand back to the rightful owner. and that, of course, it happened to me it happened in gradations, but ultimately when both my parents died, I did some work around handing their piece back to them, kind of back to the mother line and the father line. Like, this isn't mine. I don't know why I'm carrying this around. Mm-hmm. You know, I had others who were born in the early to mid 60s and had parents who jumped headfirst into the counterculture. Also, you know, I've met a lot of us out there. We were raised by wolves, kind, loving, insightful, funny, creative wolves, but nonetheless left to raise ourselves in many ways. And so that was a piece of it for me, was addiction and alcoholism. And then the other piece is that strange visitor I call fame. That really does a job on you growing up in the shadow of that without you even realizing it until you wake up one day and see it for what it is. But that's a weird one too. That's a weird one too.
Yeah. And it's well spelled out in the book, in all of its light and shadow.
Yeah.
But you know, one thing throughout the book, and especially through, you know, your parents did get cleaned up after some time, quite some time. But even in the midst of it all, and you had a family that had love.
Yeah.
Right? That's a huge difference. I mean, I would say I have a similar thing with, in particular, my father, who was very tyrannical, and it was a huge issue for me. and certainly created a large part of the story I tell myself on a day-to-day and act out still. But there was love. And I know other people where that's not the case, that there was so radical self-interest on the parents' side that that really did not exist. And for you, talk about it, just in terms of the kind of unit you had with your mother and father.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, there, I was lucky in that way, that foundationally I knew I belonged somewhere. And I was an only child. And so from almost day one, I went on the road with my parents. My dad was a starving comedian, a starving artist, and my mom was part of the team. They were a starving artist, comrade in arms. And we were the Three Musketeers. My dad called us the Three Musketeers. And they put me in a little bassinet in the back seat of the Dodge Dart. And we went off to, you know, hell gigs, as they call them in the business, where my dad made, you know, $7 a night. And sometimes there weren't even people in the audience.
Except my $7? Mom. You're not exaggerating.
I'm not exaggerating.
Oh, my God.
And we were hungry for a long time. And so there was this sense of we were in it together. And even during the dark addiction, alcoholism times, after, you know, there'd be a big blow up or something, and my dad would come bring us together to reconcile, and we would all do a big family hug, and he'd say, you know, remember, we are the Three Musketeers, you know, all for one, one for all. And so there was a sense of connection, and that kept me afloat. And I did, I felt in that basic way loved. And then of course, certainly had to make my own struggle with learning to love myself and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Why we get on the whole spiritual path initially. Mm. And, you know, and had to also learn to feel the betrayal of the addiction and the alcoholism too. You know, it's a mighty beast, those things. And when it comes ravaging through the living room or the family, you know, it's a force of nature, addiction, and can leave you feeling cast out, you know, exiled from something. So, yeah.
I mean, I love how you have interesting karma, shall we say, because, I mean, we all do, but yours to find what you found a little bit later, not that much later in life, in terms of dealing with yourself and finding the things that were the most important to you, and how they all and how your family and that love kind of aligned with those newfound values, it seemed to me as I read the book. Now, one of the first things that caught my eye, so there's a number of things in the book that where you quote your father, and they're so they're right in the nexus of, yeah, right, that's what that is. So there's a few of these things that are just pretty wonderful. But you talk about your father dropping acid. Now, I don't know why that, you say in 1969. So then I go back, okay, so that's around the time I was doing that, I guess. And I love what he said later, which was, LSD is a values changer. Yeah. Talk a little bit about how what you understood from his experience eventually, which was, I think, really contributed a lot towards the path that you eventually took.
Yeah. The way he talked about it certainly was, you know, he'd had some connection to growing up in the streets of New York and a real sense of self in some ways, but he had bought into an identity, an idea of who he thought he wanted to be. And his initial dream was to be like Danny Kaye. You know, I can't think of a squarer guy than Danny Kaye. But my dad's, you know, 8-year-old self saw him on the screen and saw his articulation and his comedic ability. And, you know, my dad was already Danny Kaye in some ways. So he was an amazing early child genius with this kind of stuff. And so he, you know, he took that road. He bought into it. He bought into the suit and the tie and the short hair and the route to get there. Like, he was trying to get to the place where he could be himself. I think that's ultimately, isn't that really what we're all doing all the time is, oh, I'll just get on this path and eventually I'll get to be myself, not thinking we actually have permission today. And in 69, he was getting already personally fed up with being put into a box of the hippy dippy weatherman everywhere he went, and dropped a lot of acid that year, from what I understand, from what I read about it. He never like told me, but when I read about it from even in his memoir, you know, dozens of times. And it did, it let him see that he was living by false, it was false values. It was a false self. He saw the false self so clearly, and saw that he himself wasn't even in his act as an artist. He wasn't even an artist. He was just an entertainer at that time. And he saw that he wasn't even present. And he had some profound awakenings, you know, during some of those trips. And we moved to Venice Beach we were in a rental in Beverly Hills and living the perfect kind of life. And then we moved to Venice and he grew his hair out and Class Clown and FNAM came out and he was dropping a lot of acid and they were doing a lot of that stuff down there. And I remember him telling me, you know, him seeing a tennis shoe in the gutter somewhere and him knowing that he was no different than even that object. Like, he saw that he was everything in the universe, and that if he's everything in the universe, then there was nothing to be afraid of ever. And I've been talking a lot lately, and actually was talking today with some people about this idea of belonging, and that just by being a sentient being, or even, you know, the non-sentient beings around us and the objects around us, but just by being here, we belong. And I think that's what he was saying. And that, you know, that values changing thing, it's like a new lens comes up and now you're like, oh, now I see what's real. Yeah. And gave him the courage to take that next step, to grow his hair out, to speak from his own self. And that's what his FMAM album was about, because the first side was AM, which was the version of him that he was, but he wanted to introduce his audience in a really beautiful way. It's such a profoundly conscious way he did this as an artist. And on the AM side was the hippy dippy weatherman and the Indian sergeant and all the bits he'd been doing on The Tonight Show and Sullivan and all of those TV shows that he was known for. And then on the FM side, he introduces himself to the audience with routines about his neighborhood and about language and stuff. And it just this clever, as always, beautiful personal introduction to this transformation. He had this internal transformation he'd had.
Well, at that time when that was happening, the FM part with him and the long hair and everything, and talk about belonging. So myself, I felt, okay, he's kindred, okay? George is kindred. He was like family, just because he was, just in the same way, like for me, I got saved. I was a miserable teenager and getting terrorized, but I got saved by Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan, just because, okay, he was expressing the angst. He was expressing the anxiety. He was expressing what was deep down in us. What in the hell are we doing here? This is nuts. Yeah. And George fits in that right on, you know, and talk about belonging, because that's what we didn't have. I think, you know, Duncan Trussell, I think.
Good friend. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he and I have been talking about this a lot. We do podcasts together at different times. He comes to these retreats in Maui. And we've been talking about just this kind of the thing that binds us and takes us into a place where we're able to get spacious enough not to believe in these stories that we're telling ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. There has to be a bigger matrix, a bigger story than our narrower stories, our personal stories. And I think it's a process. I think you have to, A, get awakened to that there is a story going on. Like, oh, I'm living out a story and I'm telling myself the story over and over again. And it's limiting my potential, or it's creating anxiety and depression, or whatever it is. So that's like an important part of the process, is owning your story. And in order for me to write my memoir and do my solo show, I had to do that work. I had to own my story. And sometimes in owning our story, we have to, you know, own our rage and own our pity and own our victimhood. Like, be able to say, fuck, man, fucked up shit happened to me. Yeah. But then at some point you have to go, and so now what? And I know for me, that's that searching, that meaning, like, what is the bigger meaning in it all? And how do I fit into this bigger meaning? And how do I belong in the bigger story? You know, that's where the seeking mind, the curiosity, the there's got to be more than just this family drama going on.
Or there's got to be more than what's in my head that I believe in. Yeah. Way more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then doing the, you know, the dance with all of that, which is God, no God, non-God, self, no self, archetypes, you know, I mean, then you just start walking through it all and trying to sort through all the concepts and the ideas, and hopefully get to have a few experiences that make you go, oh, okay. I get it.
Everybody has those. So everybody. And it's we just don't have a way in this culture to support those experiences.
Yeah.
We just, and in fact, you're thought to be crazy if you've had any, you know, out-of-body experiences or anything like that.
Yep.
Or
a sucker. You're a sucker.
Yeah.
That's the other one. That's the atheist skeptic perspective, which is you're just a sucker falling for something, and you're just living in fantasy or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sharon Salzberg. You know Sharon is?
Yeah. Yeah, I know Sharon. I've met her a few times.
Oh, yeah. She's wonderful. And so we do a lot of stuff together. And she was in a talk talking about love, and it was about Ram Dass, as you know, how much we're involved with him. I am, and have been since, we don't even want to say. it was about unconditional love. And she's just talking about, well, love, just forget anything, just love, that feeling, that emotion. Now people will get after you and go, okay, like that's especially Buddhists. So they will say that's weak. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because you're living for them. It's, of course, you're living in subject object, and you got to cut through that, which is the whole thing of Zen, which I know that's very much part of your life at this point. By the way, I love this thing that happened to me. Nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm thinking about it. Well, a little bit to do. But I did a podcast with Roshi Joan Halifax, a Zen abbot, right?
I've been to Upaya. Oh,
you have? Oh, okay. So yes. You know. And she's like, take no prisoners at all, ever, you know, kind of attitude. And we're doing this thing. I asked her, because she's been so close to Ram Dass forever, and they're always joking back and forth about that self, no self, and soul, no, you know, all of that. And it means nothing, because there's so much love alive in the room when you're with them. It's extraordinary, actually. And so due to that, I've spent some time with her. And I said to her, you know, you're close to Ram Dass, and you've seen, he talks about his guru all the time, named Karoli Baba Maharaj, our guru. So what do you think of him, you know, being that your path is the path of Zen Buddhism? And she says, when I look in his eyes in the picture, I see emptiness. And she had been and done a thing with Ram Dass where he recalled himself that and said, I just looked in those eyes and it was empty. Empty of the little guy self,
right,
is really what we're talking about. So we commiserated over that. That was a beautiful moment. Mm. And then she says, but you know, this path is eventually, you have to cut through the subject-object thingy. She didn't quite say it like that. And I said, Roshi, I don't know, you probably had about a billion more lifetimes than me. I'm hanging on for dear life to that blanket on that Baba, okay? She laughed like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because I've been having some experiences lately working with this dream tending work. I work with this gentleman, Steven Eisenstadt, who started Pacifica Graduate Institute. And he's worked with, you know, he was a student of Joseph Campbell's and James Hillman. It's all archetypal imaginal psychology. And in this work, when image, dream image comes in, figure or landscape, it's about being in relationship with it and having autonomy and independence and doing like what Jung used to call active imagination. So I'm doing this work for over a year now, and how I'm kind of putting it in the matrix of everything that I've already done. And it's interesting you brought up Ram Dass and his guru, because, you know, 20 years ago I would listen to Ram Dass's tapes and he would talk about his guru, and I would kind of like be like, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm fascinated by it, but I don't understand it. I haven't had that experience. Yeah. And then, like, you know, the kind of the skeptic atheist part of me looks in and totally rolls my eyes, like magical thinking time going on. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, after doing this dream tending work and being in conscious relationship with figures, imaginal figures, both through dream tending and through shamanic journeying stuff, what I'm getting about it is that it is not subject-object, actually, because you're not in the ego self when you're in relationship with these figures. You're in a matrix, and you're just a witnessing participant in it. And ego must move out of the way for you actually to be in true relationship with it, to let them have autonomy and independence. And I was actually thinking about Ram Dass last week, thinking like, oh, I think I get this now. Mm-hmm. Like not a full experience of it, but I'm like, I think I get that. Yeah. It's not Ram Dass's ego having a relationship with his guru. It's his soul having a relationship with his guru soul, you know, or something. I mean, you can't put words to this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You just did a great job, Kelly. I don't care. I'm going to have this extracted out of here, and I'm going to show it. I'm going to type it, get somebody to show it to Ram Dass. Okay. Well, I'll see him in a week, so I'll show it to myself.
And then let me know if I'm on the right path.
You are. Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, it encompasses everything, including that part of us that is, shall we say, challenged. That's all there as well.
Yeah.
You know what I love, though? This is my favorite thing in the book, but not really, you know, you say this about it, but it made me laugh so hard. Like, your father was looking for blow, right? And where did he stash it? He stashed it in Be Here Now. He goes, oh, right, Ram Dass, Be Here Now. Is that real? I mean, come on.
My memory of it is, I don't remember what book it was stashed in, but I remember Be Here Now was on our coffee table 24/7. And I remember as a kid looking at the book. And so when I couldn't remember, I used, a little dramatic, fun theatrical license with that, with moments like that. Mm. But I thought it would be fun to put it in that book because why not? I mean, you know, and Ram Dass was there. He was on our freaking coffee table through all of it.
And another, I know somebody who's maybe, I don't know how well you knew him, but he appears and he's somebody we love too, Gary Shandling.
He was a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one time, Gary, not that long ago, maybe within 2 years before Gary died, Judd Apatow wanted to talk to Ram Dass. So we arranged a Skype thing. And Judd, I think what happened is Gary called Judd. I think Judd told us this. He said, "Well, what are you doing?" "Oh, well, I'm going to be doing a Skype with Ram Dass." He says, "And you didn't invite me? I want to come." So he came over. You know, like Gary was a mentor to Judd Apatow a close friend. Mm-hmm. And so we did this incredible Skype thing, which Judd included in the Gary Shandling.
Yeah, there's a small the DVD. Clip of in the it's in the documentary, the full documentary too.
But then he put the whole thing on the DVD.
We did. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm gonna have
Although
to the DVD
he never sent me one. I gotta get that. there's just this beautiful part in it. Well, you saw it. I think this part's in it. Maybe not though. Where he gets on Gary. "Hi, Ram Dass." He says, "Do you know who I am?" So sweetly, like with no airs whatsoever. And Ram Dass goes, "Gary, I know who you are." That was worth the price of admission for me. So great. What a great person.
Yeah, Gary.
Talent. It's my favorite show, the Gary show, you know, the interview, fake interview show.
Whatever. Yeah, he came to my dad's memorial. I didn't know Gary before my dad died. And he right away was one of a few comedians who said to me, "I'm family and I'm here for you." And Gary was the one person I could go to and kind of unpack my dad's stuff in a private way that I wasn't ready to unpack publicly, my own struggling with it. I mean, obviously I missed my dad dearly, but my struggling with finding who I was outside of this relationship now. And so Gary was a steady, steady person for me. And he and I did not know he was a practicing Buddhist until I met him and we started talking about it. And he didn't really share that publicly. And I'm really glad that Judd brought that side to Gary, to the world, because Gary was such a questioner about everything. And he was a mentor and a friend and this Zen voice would, you know, and then he would be so absurd and funny and neurotic, like as neurotic Jew as possible.
Yeah. All the way.
Oh, totally. All the way. He owned it all. He played all the keys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, he was a real practitioner, my understanding.
He was. He was.
He really sat.
He really sat. And he you know, when Thich Nhat Hanh's community wanted to buy property here in California for their in America thing, he donated the land to them.
Really?
Wow. He did.
That's generous. That's wonderful.
Yeah, truly amazing.
Of course, the other he's not that much in the book, Richard Pryor, but he's kind of throughout the book in a way, because of the, I mean, for me, they were parallel. I mean, there were people I looked to and went, okay, yeah, truth sayers. I want to just read this one thing you put in the book, which is from George at Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. It has to do with Richard. It's just funny. "I would like to bring you up to date on the comedian's health sweepstakes as it stands now. I lead Richard Pryor in heart attacks, 2-1. However, Richard still leads me 1-0 on burning yourself up." Well, the way it happened was, first Richard had a heart attack, then I had a heart attack, then Richard burned himself up, then I said, "Fuck it, I'm going to have another heart attack." Oh, God.
It's so genius.
You know what? Can I mean, we're in the middle of a podcast, so I'm going to ask you this. I don't care. Can we play a little something of George, a clip or something?
Please, yeah, go ahead. Yeah? Of course.
Okay.
We're gonna
do it then.
I love that. That'd be awesome. Dad would be happy with that.
Oh, so great.
I don't have a nice day anymore. I don't bother much with that. I think I'm beyond that now. I think I've outgrown the nice day. I think I've had my share. Why should I be hogging all the really nice ones? Let somebody else have a few. Of course, everybody still wants me to have one. Everybody wants me to have a nice day.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You want to give me my fucking change, please? I'm triple parked. Some of them are really insistent. I said, have a nice day. All right, goddamn it. All right, I'll give it a shot. That's the trouble with have a nice day. It puts all the pressure on you. Now you've got to go out and somehow manage to have a good time. All because of some loose-lipped cashier. Have a nice day. Maybe I don't feel like having a nice day. Maybe, just maybe, I've had 116 nice days in a row. And I'm ready, by God, for a crappy day. I'll never hear that. Let him wish one of them. Hey, have a crappy day. Thank you, and to your wonderful family as well. Crappy day. Hey, that'd be easy. It's no trouble at all. A crappy day. Just get up. There's no planning involved for a crappy day. I know what it is that bothers me about that whole thing. It's the word nice. It's just a weak word. Doesn't have a lot of character, you know.
Nice. Isn't he nice? Oh, he is so nice. And she's nice, too. Isn't that nice? How nice they are.
I don't care for that, you know. It's like fine. There's another word. How are you?
Fine.
Bullshit! Nobody's fine. Hair is fine. How's your hair?
Fine.
That makes a lot more sense to me. Some guys are great. You ever meet those guys? Great. Isn't this great? God damn, this is great. Look, they're gonna kill that guy. Isn't that great? That's great. No, not me. I'm not nice. I'm not fine. I'm not great. People ask me how I am. I say I'm fairly decent. I don't give them any superlatives, nothing to gossip about. Relatively okay. Sometimes I'll say, I'm moderately neato. If I'm in a particularly jaunty mood, I'll say, I'm not unwell, thank you. That pisses them off because they have to figure that one out for themselves.
Am I off, or maybe a first, not, I don't know, awakening's too weighty a word here, but there was something around Shirley MacLaine and her book, Out on a Limb, that did something for you, right? What happened there?
Yeah. I was, well, you know, it's that thing where I was such a seeker. I was at my mom and I and my friend Teresa, we were at that Bodhi Tree bookstore in L.A.
I love that. That's the worst thing that happened in L.A. when that went away.
Heartbreaking. They're just voraciously new aging my way through my 20s, trying to find answers, trying to find my feet on the ground, really. And then that Shirley MacLaine book happened. And, you know, she was out there, you know, and yet it was like, oh my God, I want to have some of these experiences and these things. And then, you know, so she becomes like this this icon of seeking person for me and fascinated by her. And then I go to the American Comedy Awards and my dad's like said, oh, Shirley MacLaine's here and I want to introduce you. And I'm like, oh, the goddess is in the house. And we go and we go over and I don't realize that, you know, those funny little glasses, and they had all these like little props on the tables at the American Comedy Awards. And one of them was those glasses with the nose and the fake mustache. And I've put them on my forehead like this, you know, and I don't even know that they're on my forehead. And it was just one of those moments where I'm like, oh, Shirley, hello, hello, hello. And then I walk away and I realize I have these glasses on my forehead. And I think, oh, humility. Instantly. But yeah, she was that, you know, she was one of those first people who got me interested in seeking. But it was that kind of seeking of like, oh, help me out of my hell. Please just bring me to the light. I don't want any shadow. I don't want to deal with the hell. I just want to go towards the light and towards peace and being and beauty and all of that, which I think is an initial pull for most people, for a lot of people in their spiritual life, you know? So yeah. And then my mom died and a whole nother consciousness came into my being. And I had quite an awakening on the day of my mother's funeral.
Talk about that.
Yeah, it was, I had always imagined when my mother died that I would lose my mind. I thought that I would absolutely, like, they'd have to drug me or put me in a room for a little while. And the whole week, but especially the day of my mother's memorial, I was so in my body like I had never been my entire life. I was so calm. I was so connected. And I was holding the space for family and dear friends. My mother was an AA sponsor and had a lot of people that she had been the mother to. And she was a healer, a natural healer, and a natural kind of shamanic energy without any training or anything. And I was suddenly holding the space for everyone and just felt an enormous amount of love and joy in my body that I still tell people that that day was one of the most beautiful days of my life. I met some sort of love consciousness that day. I got, and I talked about it in her memorial when I got up there. I talked about how Joseph Campbell talks about how you have to, you know, joyfully be with the sorrows of the world. And there was this real sudden holding the tension of the opposites and being in the polarity of the deepest loss and grief I'd ever had in my life. Half my body had been cut off, it felt like. And yet here I was in an extreme state of unconditional love and grace. And my mother, the day after she died, she came to me in the shower and put her arms around me. And I'd never had an experience like that. And I called it my Shirley MacLaine experience. But I remember jumping out of the shower after my mother had come to me and said to me, you're going to be okay. I was in my parents' house and I threw some clothes on and I ran across the house to tell my dad. And my dad says, fuck, man, cool shit like that never happens to me. He was so jealous that I'd had this experience. But, you know, and I didn't understand it. I understand it more now, but I just knew that I'd had this experience and I couldn't, it was real. It was as real as the chair I'm sitting on, my mother. So something happened to me that week around the loss. And I really do believe that loss, profound loss like that, can be such a gift of awakening, because it can, you meet some sense of yourself that you've never met before. And I think it's a wider, bigger, more connected sense of self that's grounded in that bigger matrix we were talking about earlier. And that's really when I really decided to start walking on a path, and I ended up going to a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat about 4 months later. Yeah.
But so many people, of course, we all, I mean, many of us, of course, our parents are going to die, and we come to that moment. But the way in which the moment expressed itself to you is very unique. And speaks again to, as I mentioned, you have pretty interesting karma. It speaks to that.
Yeah.
And that's another word, of course. It's another woo-hoo thing, because it's not something we can understand with rational mind. But just the idea of all of the events, not from just this life. I mean, as if you're a believer in karma and reincarnation, but from many lives, and certainly how we get developed in this life based on what family we landed with and what society and what political system, all of that kind of thing. So for you to realize the truth, this is how it sounds to me. You had a really deep realization of the truth of this is just a body. This is not who we are. And the thing I have with my mother is beyond these bodies that we had. And that thing embraces everyone if you open to it in the moment. And somehow you did.
Yeah, somehow I did. And yeah, whatever this narrative I'm living out and these parents I got and this path I'm on and this, I mean, like, if it's, you know, however we get here and whatever's the other, I don't logically know any of it, but I saw beyond the veil. I was living for months that way. It was a very liminal space I was in. It happened after my father died too, for a few months, a very liminal space where the other side was right. So tangible, the field, what's the way we kind of talk about it, that field opens up, that morphogenic field in some ways, where you can feel and see into it. And no matter how rational I want to be, or how reasonable or logical that perspective wants to come up and try to explain it away, I know what I experienced, I know what I lived into, and I know the truth that came into my every cell of my body. And I can't deny that. I can't. I remember I was doing my solo show for an atheist convention.
That's my funny. I don't.
It is funny. My director, Paul Provenz, is friends with a lot of the atheists and Dawkins and all those people. And he's in that world. And Paul's a great guy. And, you know, he's a very open-minded man. It's a lot of experiences. But he's friends with those people. And he booked my show there. And of course, I always make fun of the atheists because they worship my father as they worship Richard Dawkins. I always try to let them know, you know, we are worshiping beings at the bottom line, you know, we're hardwired for it, baby. Yeah. So, but I was really, really worried when I took the show because I was going to talk about some of these things, this experience with my mother and a couple of other things that had happened in my life. And I was very worried that they were just going to shut down and put me in a box like I think they like to do. And Gary Shandling, had a lot of anxiety about this show. And Gary said to me, Kelly, there's a lot of IQ in that room, but there's not a lot of EQ. And you bring the emotional intelligence. So bring that to them. They're in great need of it. It's a great gift you're giving to that audience. And so I remember standing backstage, and it was a real moment for me as an artist too, because I know my dad had been on his own path as an artist, having the courage to speak more and more of his truth. And I really saw this as a crossroads for me as an artist. Like, this is my story. No matter what, I felt my mother's arms around me in that shower. I had this expansive consciousness raising thing that happened because of this. I'm here to tell my story. And it really helped me claim my own experience around it and not having to explain it. And I went out and I did the show. I got a standing ovation, 500 atheists, really? Standing ovation. And then afterwards, I always go out to greet people. And I had grown men sobbing in my arms. Yeah. And so, you know, yeah, I just brought, I brought my truth and was not afraid of it. And I'm always in a lot of humility around it because I don't even want to pretend that I really understand any of this stuff. And yet I can only know what I know and treat it with respect. So
I think George's installation of commitment to truth in your family has a lot to do with this, I think. Because that's the toughest thing of all, telling the truth.
Yeah, and it's been my unpacking these last 10 years since he was gone to find that for myself. And part of it was telling my story finally. You know, you've read my book, you know my dad's resistance to me being more public with my story because of his own angst, his own personal angst around the drug addiction and how it he felt so guilty and so bad for whatever damage or woundedness that did for me to me. And he had such a resistance to me telling my story. And yet there's a part of the book where, you know, I'm going to do a solo show and he says, like, I can't be there. And we go to my therapist's office and he says, you know, I'm an artist and you're an artist and I'd never tell you what to say or not to say. And so this last 10 years has been me giving myself more and more permission to not only live into my truth, but to be public with it and to talk about it and to come out of the closet over and over and over again about my personal pain and my personal story. But beyond that, it's not really about that. It's about the reality I'm experiencing and seeing and the conversation I want to be having with life with a capital L. And so, yeah, I've, you know, if there's any shoes that I want to stand in my father's shoes, it's that. It's that willingness to disappoint people with truth in service of their enlightenment, but having no agenda to it at the same time. Yeah. Like, it's not my job to have an agenda around that.
Yeah, yeah.
But my dad would bring a truth in his comedy where you would be like, he'd pop your balloon of, you know, false belief or the dreaming of the American dream or whatever that was. He would constantly pop these balloons and you'd be disappointed in the moment, like, oh, and then but then you'd feel the truth of it. And then you'd be freed by the truth of it. So there's something about that that I absolutely feel I was born into this family for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a wonderful thing in the book, actually. It's when your father took you on a helicopter ride in Hawaii around the volcano. And right through the center of it. And you said its energy was like nothing I'd ever encountered, a raw, unflinching creation happening right before my eyes. My body and mind felt entered by a force beyond anything I had ever imagined. I knew I was looking at the ultimate unknown / known otherness of life itself, otherwise known as the big mystery. As the pilot made another pass, I looked over at my dad and saw that he was holding a small picture of my mom, and your mother had died not that long before, angled so that she could see Pele as well, which is so sweet. In that moment, I knew that human love, raw, aching, cut you in half, human love, was part of the same creation that was inside the volcano, that both these forces were equal in their ability to build something up and to cut us in two. And then just a bursting of love. That's a great analogy, though. I have to say, I love that little part in the book because the mystery that you describe of what that is, the power of it, and the fact that our, and I have to, you know, just use unconditional love, not the business love that we all have going in our lives. But that unconditional, where you're not looking for anything in return, and that purity contained in that, with that analogy of Pele, that's really wonderful. Just had to say that.
Thank
Okay.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. It's one of those passages when you write it, you just bow down to the muse because it just pours through you. Yeah.
So I think your experience with Thich Nhat Hanh in Santa Barbara when you went to that was probably elemental, very much maybe like when I went to India and followed Ram Dass and met Neem Karoli Baba. I think that has to be part of a big part of what's where you are now and who you are now. No?
Yeah, it was a surrendering into community, that being an only child and my dad being such a rebel loner artist, not something naturally was, you know, trained to do or born in to do, and always being an outsider and going to that retreat in Santa Barbara. It was in 97, the fall of 97. And while we were there, Princess Diana died. It was really just a weird thing. My mom had died only a few months earlier. But it was my coming out as a person, a seeker. I remember being terrified to tell my husband and my dad that I was going to a Buddhist retreat. And they all looked at me like, okay. I'm like, what was I so afraid of? It's so funny. The stuff we put into our heads. And going there and there being 1,200 people there. And like them all, you know, if anyone listening has been to a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, there's a long of sing-songy camp songs. And the first day I'm sitting there going, oh, I don't want to drink the Kool-Aid. I'm really afraid. And very resistant and very judgy. And then the next morning I went on a walking meditation with Thay and the nuns and the monks and about 600 or 500 people, however many of us walked, and doing this. I mean, I hadn't even done 10 minutes of sitting meditation in my life. I'd listened to Thich Nhat Hanh tapes a couple of times, the guided stuff, and never done walking meditation. And we walk through this, it's at UCSB, and there's this nature reserve, and we're walking through the nature reserve, hundreds of us walking meditation. And I look over and there's this fox hunting, and he's like 50 feet away and he doesn't even notice us. He doesn't even, we are so part of the fabric of the place and so in it, hundreds of us. And I think, wow, there's something to this. And I think it was about on the fourth day I was singing the songs now. I got it. Like I was part of it. And I was feeling, you know, there's nothing better than singing with a group of people anyway. But really surrendering into it. And I remember Thay came out and gave a Dharma talk. And I don't even remember what it was about. For 20 minutes, there was an amount of energy coming from him into my body. Some sort of transmission was happening. I didn't have any understanding of it. I just thought, I don't know what's going on, but felt it. And and then joined a sangha after that, a great sangha where we all said, you know, we're all the type of people who don't belong to groups. Like every single person in the sangha was an outsider type. It was great. So it was really perfect. And for a good 5 years, I was a regular, sit on my cushion, go to lots of retreats, do silent retreats, putting those hours on the cushion type of person that really helped me settle into my body and really get to enter that matrix of love we were talking about earlier. And wrestling with the ego, you know, going on a retreat in the first 24 hours, wanting to murder everybody and eat chocolate. And and if anyone had heroin, even though I'd never done it before, I'd probably do it. And then 36 hours in, something cracks open and your heart goes bam, and suddenly you're in love with everything and everyone. And just watching that, myself do that year after year, retreats and stuff, and thinking, wow, I don't understand this, but this is interesting. So yeah
it goes back to the first thing that we talked about, that you talked about, the sense of belonging. The sangha, satsang, as the Hindus call it, this is like the core thing I've been experiencing for these last number of years. As we do retreats, we do them here at Ojai, actually where I am now, and we do them in Maui, and now they're going to spread around the country, we hope. Because we do them in India, these pilgrimages to the foothills of the Himalayas, where we were with Neem Karoli Baba Ram Dass, me, Krishnadas, and others. And the same thing, I mean, they're very different in some ways, different teachers, different themes, whatever, but the same thing happens in each one of these, and that is people feeling completely belonging to each other. And yeah. I like that. I wouldn't have said that it that way. I would have said a common heart opens up so that everyone can dwell in that heart free and easy without and leave their baggage at the door. But that belonging, because it gives a sense of deep connection in a family way. And that's really what, and to me, it's the most, and as the Buddha said, when they asked him about taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which is the most important? And of course, Sangha. And for anybody who is, this is all, by the way, I have been saying the same shit here forever, but certainly it our paths are so much more lightened by our ability to be with each other and know that we are not alone. And these problems of day-to-day that we have, mostly to do with our minds, certainly circumstances, financial and otherwise, play a major role. That's how we're all in the same boat, and that's how we help each other, is through this community. So yeah, very, very important.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've just started reading Maladoma Somei's work. Do you know him?
Yeah.
Yeah, and just reading about his second book, which is about healing, ritual, and community, and just this essentialness of village and community, and you know how different it is being raised in the Western world in a nuclear family, you know. And certainly if you were born in the 60s or the 70s, there's no church, there's no nothing, there's no connection. And now we have this thing called social media, which is a promise of community in some ways. And there is connection in it in some ways. I really find psyche, it to be fascinating how psyche's created this new conversation we're having. And yet there's nothing like being in community, in retreat presence with other bodies. That you can't get in social media. You just can't get it. But our searching for connection through this technology, and yet here we are using this technology today to connect and have this conversation. So what a blessing that is.
Yeah. It's the light and the dark are in this big time, huh?
Big time.
But I'll tell you, we did an online course just now called Alchemy of Love, Ram Dass Meditations, through our Love Server Member Foundation. And maybe there was like 11,000 people who took this thing.
Yeah.
But they created, our people created a Facebook group. So people could, because they want, people, we want to dialogue with each other. And there was half the people, maybe not quite, but I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 people certainly were on that. And I just saw some of the exchanges between people. It fulfilled some of what we're talking about. That's for sure.
It does. It can. Absolutely. Done. Yeah. You know, it can. I agree.
So we're kind of at the end of our hour here. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, Dove Soap is saying we can't talk anymore. I don't know. Whoever said that is so stupid. And Kelly, Kelly, I mean, you have a podcast, I know, that's still.
Yeah, it's been on pause. I'm going to start in the new year again. It's called Waking from the American Dream. There's over 140 episodes up. I started it in 2010, I think I started. I can't even remember. Well, 2011, a couple of years after my dad died. And it's from a line my dad had said about, you know, something about It's called The American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe in it. And
okay.
So
our guy's doing show notes for this. There you go. There's the title.
There's one you can play. And so I was so inspired by that line that I wanted to talk about waking up in all forms. Yeah. So part of it's about America, but it's really waking up in all forms.
Right.
So I have a podcast. Yeah. And I have a SiriusXM show, the Kelly Carlin show that I interview comedians on, which lately we've been drilling down very deep. And I just did a half hour or an hour with Jeff Foxworthy.
Oh, really?
Who on paper, we probably have very little to talk about, and yet we had a profound, profound conversation. Yeah.
So. It's amazing that we can find commonality somewhere in any situation.
I say 85% of even the person on the most extreme political poll of you'll 85% we have in common because we're just humans.
Yep. Yeah, 85. So, yeah, another 15 has become a bit of a problem, but it's okay.
Fancy little problem, but yeah.
KellyCarlin.com?
Yeah, KellyCarlin.com. You can find all my stuff there, my women's coaching stuff and blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Okay, great. But,
and I'm on Twitter. Find me on Twitter. I just left Facebook. I'm done with
Instagram.
Facebook.
You got to get on Instagram.
And I'm on Instagram too, so come find me.
Okay, just one more thing from George. From the book that is so great. It's from his show, The Planet is Fine. Right? Mm-hmm. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. The planet's been through a lot worse than us, been through all kinds of things worse than us, been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, hundreds of thousands of years of bombardment by comets and asteroids and meteors, worldwide floods, tidal waves, worldwide fires, erosion, cosmic rays, recurring ice ages. And we think some plastic bags and some aluminum cans are going to make a difference? The planet isn't going anywhere. And only he could have said. Of course, we'll get flack back about.
And he got flack for that too.
Yeah, I bet.
The environmentalists really came down on him for that. And his point was that the yuppies, the people who had started the earth.
The forgotten yuppies, yeah.
Yes, they'd turned into the greedy yuppies. And they only wanted to save the planet for their own convenience.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's I've actually talked about this in very subject with people who are been doing environmental work for a long, long time. Yeah. So that's a whole other podcast we can do, Kelly.
It is.
About that. Yeah. Which, yeah, maybe we should one day. So great to meet you, Kelly Carlin. And we hope to see you soon.
I hope to see you in Ojai.
Yes, you're going to come out here for sure. We're going to get you out here.
You're right up the road from me, so I will come and see you.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So, check out show notes, and you'll be able to get Kelly's book because there'll be a lovely link there. And also George's, we'll figure out which book. Whoever's going to be doing this, I'm sure, is going to say, I like this George book better than that. So you can put whatever you want. And linking up to Kelly. And again, thank you so much for being on Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. I still like the thing where George found the flow in Be Here Now. Okay. I'm going to believe we shouldn't have even said that. It's true.
It's true. Of course it's true. Exactly.
We'll see you next week on BeHereNowNetwork.com on Mind Rolling. Bye bye.